The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
Hello, and welcome to Ask the Experts. My name is Dr. Gurtej Singh, and I'm an interventional physiatrist practicing with the Centers for Advanced Orthopedics in the suburbs of Baltimore, Maryland. I'm joined here with two of my colleagues, Dr. Rick Placide.
Mm-hmm. Hello, Rick Placide. I'm a orthopedic spine surgeon. I'm a professor of orthopedics at Medical College of Virginia in Richmond, Virginia, and I specialize in complex spine surgery.
Thanks, Rick. And Dr. Zach McCormick.
Yep, Zach McCormick. I'm at the University of Utah, chief of spine and musculoskeletal medicine, and I'm a physiatrist, so thanks for having me.
Welcome to my colleagues, and thank you for joining us today. The topic of our Ask the Experts session today is refractory chronic low back pain. We're going to discuss three cases, and we'll get started now with case number one. So case number one, we'll look at a, let's say, late 40s, early 50-year-old patient, very active, comes in with primarily a midline axial low back pain symptom. Complains that bending forward, picking up objects bother him quite a bit. Fortunately, he doesn't have any neurogenic symptoms and his neurological exam is normal. On MRI findings, you do see degenerative disc disease throughout the spine. You also see type 1 modic end plate changes, clearly at L4 and L5, maybe a little hint at S1 as well. He's obviously failed some conservative therapies and now he's in our office. So what do we do? Dr. McCormick, I'll start with you. So here in this scenario, where would the role of either an epidural steroid injection, a facet injection, or even a steroid injection to the disc play?
So probably a little more history would be helpful for us. Sure. But I guess the nature of the conservative care that the patient's already been through, and then as you're thinking about facet versus disc, some of the positional preferences, I think you mentioned, you know, forward flexion type activities were bothersome, so that definitely would be hinting at an anterior column type pathology. Yeah. You know, what classically we've called discogenic pain, but probably should be calling disc over tibial pain, kind of along that spectrum. You know, and then some more so the extension-based pain, thinking facet, posterior column, sure, posterior element type pain. But I think I would want to have a better understanding with this particular individual, how much, you know, I guess, physical therapy, exercise, other like mechanical-based interventions, have they already made it through? If they really haven't tried a whole lot, or I'm not confident that they've really maximized what they could do from an exercise or a formal physical therapy standpoint, I'm going to guide them in that direction first. If that's not really, you know, doing enough for them, which of course, you know, this is the case often, then we might start thinking about some of these injections. So I think you mentioned epidural, facet, and intradiscal?
Yes.
Okay. So presuming that, if we're assuming that this patient has more of an anterior column pathology, we're on the same page there. You know, I guess our options really are epidural versus intradiscal. Okay. So tricky thing here now, you know, insurance plays a role here. We can't, you know, nothing happens in isolation of insurance. So it's an epidural for axial back pain only, while it's done, that's a little tricky sometimes to get approved, right? Yeah. So without any radicular pathology whatsoever, right, you may run into prior auth problems. So right, depending on if there's any kind of hint of maybe possible radicular, you know, radiation or not in your documentation. The intradiscal steroid is an interesting question. I think there is at least one, there's a small handful of studies, one out of China, that specifically in patients with type 1 modic changes, they actually do respond really well to intradiscal steroid injection. So I'll say that I actually do use intradiscal steroid in my practice. I didn't always do that, but more recently I have, in the context of type 1 modic changes, sometimes type 2 as well. And I think we may be touching on the vasovertebral nerve ablation procedure, but I will, you know, sometimes use that as sort of an intermediary, and some folks actually do quite well with intradiscal steroid injection with this picture of type 1 modic chronic axial back pain have failed to really respond to more conservative measures. So a tool in our toolbox.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So Dr. Placide, as sort of Dr. McCormick alludes to, this patient really has exhausted months of the conservative, non-interventional, and now has been in the hands of Dr. McCormick, has had some benefit, but for a short duration of time. Mm-hmm. So still struggling, but still young in life. Where's the role of spine surgery for patients with a anterior column pathology?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I would completely agree with Dr. McCormick. I would review what kinds of physical therapy they had, or chiropractic, like true manual therapy, manipulation, the appropriate rehabilitation. You know, as we know that sometimes a patient will just get ultrasound and stimulator put on their back. That's not therapy. And then I also try to get the records from the interventionalist to know exactly what was done. The patients know they had this and that. Most patients I see do not know that exactly what they had injection-wise. So I do like to review that with the patient as well. So when it comes to a surgical point of view, there are papers studied, there's a recent meta-analysis at looking at this exact question and comparing artificial disc with standalone anterior fusion, so ALIF, anterior lumbar interbody fusion, and a circumferential, so an ALIF with a backed up posterior surgery. And the total disc replacement was the ideal for overall outcomes, Oswestry and pain scale, where the ALIF was a close second.
Okay.
So I think in this situation, we knew that the conservative measures were exhausted. My bias is still a standalone. It sounds like a relatively healthy young person. A standalone ALIF would be my preference in that situation.
And then a follow-up question. More and more data is coming out looking at what Dr. McCormick alluded to, basivertebral nerve ablation.
Mm-hmm.
I find that this could be something where both surgeons and interventionalists can join in hand mm-hmm. to help patients. Any early thoughts on this technology?
So I do like it. In our area in Richmond, there's interventional physiatrist that's been doing it. And from my standpoint, like you alluded to, the patient did well, but symptoms kept coming back.
Right.
That's diagnostic. Fair. If you're addressing a single level and it resolves the symptoms, even if it's temporary, that helps me a lot.
Great. And Dr. McCormick, you actually alluded to it first, so we'll come back to you. Basivertebral nerve ablation.
Yeah.
What are your experiences?
So I've been doing the procedure for a couple of years now, and we were the pilot site for the global registry for the procedure. So we have been collecting our outcome data, which has I've been happily surprised with. It's generally mirrored what is seen in the RCTs that have been put out, SMART and INTERCEPT trials. We have not collected data nearly as long as what came out from the SMART trial, and they have 5-year data now. But this patient that you've described, if they were to fail all of the more conservative care that we talked about, including injection-based care, in that case, I actually personally would perform medial branch blocks to rule out facets before considering the INTERCEPT procedure or basivertebral nerve ablation, just because medial branch ablation is very simple, a quick procedure, low risk. So before committing them to the 8-gauge trocar and general anesthesia, at least in my practice, I wouldn't rule out facet pathology, but from your description, those are exactly the kind of folks that do well. So if they really don't have any kind of radicular pain, maybe a touch of radiographic stenosis, but nothing symptomatic, claudication, radicular pain, no instability, scoliosis, et cetera, but clear motic changes and they've really failed everything else, those are the kind of folks that were entered into the trials and where, you see pretty robust outcomes that seem to be durable out to at least 5 years based on the data that we do have. So this patient you described is probably a great candidate for that procedure.
So we have a clear patient with anterior column pathology, someone who has both vertebrogenic base pain and possibly discogenic base pain. What's great and exciting that our experts here are able to provide us is a new and innovative procedure, something that helps patients more than just the previous diagnostic therapies, but that we still have standalone procedures and surgical procedures that can help patients who do not succeed with various interventions. Case number two, we're going to look at a patient with more of a posterior column pathology. Someone in their early to mid 60s comes in with a fairly classic story of pain when getting out of bed first thing in the morning. But by the time they make it to the bathroom or get into that warm shower, symptoms start to decrease. Patients who say that getting up after sitting for a long period of time or after a long drive just need a little bit of WD-40 to loosen up their back pain. Fortunately for them, they don't have true radicular or neuropathic features, but they will tell you that pain goes, quote, down my leg. And when you tease into that a little bit more, it's really more posterior buttock and posterior thigh, almost never crosses the knee. Again, in this clinical scenario, we're referring to somebody with refractory chronic low back symptoms. They have exhausted both medication management, multiple physical therapy, home exercises, and other traditional conservative treatments. In this sort of clinical scenario, Dr. McCormick, I feel like on the interventional side, we've got a great tried and true procedure that helps patients. So some facet or medial branch injections, whether they're diagnostic or therapeutic, followed by a thermal radiofrequency ablation. In your experience, have you found that either an intra-articular approach versus a medial branch approach has a better predictive value for RFA?
Good question. So I think the data tells us, my experience, yes, but also the data tells us some of Steve Cohen's work from Hopkins that facet joint steroid injection is a poor prognostic indicator of eventual RF outcome compared to diagnostic medial branch block. So certainly in my practice, I use, if I'm thinking that a patient may go down the RFA pathway, I would use dual diagnostic medial branch block to select the proper patient for that. For that, you know, as you said, tried and true type of intervention. You know, historically, I think many of us would try an intra-articular facet steroid injection to say, hey, you know, does a patient get better with a simple facet steroid injection? You know, one treatment, not committing them to block one, different day, block two, different day, RFA, three different procedures. And, you know, where I am at the University of Utah, we have patients that are driving 4 or 5 hours one direction to come see us from, you know, outreach areas, bordering states that don't have a lot of tertiary subspecialty care. So it was a nice solution. The trouble is most payers now, and in Medicare included, really don't allow you to do intra-articular steroid injections, or, you know, many have historically used medial branch blocks with steroid. They also won't allow you to do that. So our options are a bit more limited, where I like to be able to offer patients intra-articular steroid, and if it was not durable, well, we could say, well, do you have a diagnostic response? Yes. Well, let's try a branch block. If that's positive, that patient could have an RFA. We don't really have that ability anymore. So generally, I am, if I think of a patient has facet pathology, I'm, you know, walking down a branch block pathway towards RF. This particular patient, I would be interested first, though, in seeing their flex-ex films and their MRI, particularly given the leg referral that you mentioned. So, again, very much sounds like probable facet pain, but maybe a little radicular component. Do they have a facet joint cyst? That's a situation where we actually can use an intra-articular injection, where insurers and Medicare will allow us that option. But I would say that before committing them to an intervention, this is a debate, but I would personally get advanced imaging, and particularly with the referral into the leg.
If you decide to move on to an RFA, there have been some studies showing that different needle gauge size could play a role. In your experience, do you find a larger or smaller needle size, and do you tend to sedate patients, or are they awake for these procedures?
Yeah, good questions. So on the needle gauge, I think you look across the board at the studies, and there have been meta-analyses that have really carefully picked apart these subgroups of how patients were selected and the technique of the ablation itself. So first of all, the more rigorous you make your block criteria, the better your outcomes are going to be. You're going to have some false negatives where patients maybe could benefit from the RFA, but you've screened them out because you've created a very high bar for considering the block positive. But generally, I mean, if you're using 80% relief times two different blocks on different occasions, that's a pretty good bar. And many insurers, Medicare included now, require that bar. The second, though, is of course how the procedure is done. So I think we know that if you're using conventional RF electrodes and you take a perpendicular approach to the nerve instead of laying it parallel, your outcomes are going to suffer. And we know that from a lot of studies at this point. The MINT trials would be a good example of that, where patients didn't do well because the block criteria and the procedure technique were subpar. Assuming you're doing the procedure well, good selection and proper technique, if you're going to use a single lesion, using a large gauge needle is just going to help you cover a larger swath of the nerve, and theoretically, you know, better chance of capturing the nerve and capturing as much as possible. So I personally use larger gauge needles. There are folks that would prefer prefer to use a smaller gauge, more comfort for the patient, and that's okay, but you're going to have to use more than one burn. You're going to have to, you know, pull back on one nerve and burn again. There are also, you know, other technologies that are out there, multi-tine technologies, you know, internally water-cooled devices, and those are generally creating larger lesions. So those are situations where the approach is a little different, and you can effectively capture the nerve without needing to create two lesions or more, for example.
Right.
But I would say that generally creating a large lesion territory is going to likely improve outcomes, you know, the magnitude of that outcome and also the durability of that outcome.
Great. So, Dr. Placide, we got a patient who, again, very similar to our first case, right, has had exhaustive conservative therapies, has had some form of an intervention, and unfortunately, let's say in this scenario, they just never made it that full 6 months, which is the sort of standard criteria, to then repeat an RFA. Yeah. How does surgery play a role for this sort of patient with really just more facet-only pain?
Right. So that changes your surgical decision-making. At this point, you maybe be considering a posterior approach. So if you do a traditional open fusion, you do have to balance the level of pain and dysfunction and the disturbance of the patient's activity of daily living. So there is a realistic expectation that you're not going to have zero pain after this surgery. And if you're living at a 4 or a 3 on a pain scale, you might not see the benefits of an operation. But then you can step back and start thinking about minimally invasive surgical options, right? So percutaneous stabilization, you can percutaneously, and there's even papers on using a robot to decorticate and fuse the facet joint. There are these facet screws that traverse the facet joint. They were done originally many years ago in the cervical spine for posterior cervical stabilization, but they exist for the lumbar spine. I wouldn't think they would hold up as a standalone. Okay. You're still going to have to do some sort of stabilization, likely like a panicle screw construct, but it could be done with minimal invasive procedures.
Would we worry going forward, right? Mm-hmm. So we kind of consider the biomechanics of how somebody would have facet pathology, and if through conservative treatments, chiropractic care, home exercise, physical therapy, patients not able to really change how they move biomechanically, adjacent segment disease, is that, you know, where do we consider that if this was a one level procedure?
So there's mixed data on that. Okay. So if we're talking about a patient with just facet arthropathy and that's their pain generator, there's probably some level of spondylosis, probably some degenerative disc changes. Okay. So with considering an operation, you could also do minimally invasive percutaneous interbody fusion as well. And the reason I bring that up is when we talk about adjacent segment disease, certainly we know biomechanically and cadaverically that if you immobilize a spine segment, the other adjacent segments have increased load, right? What has not been looked at, and it's actually hard to study, we talk about restoring the sagittal balance of the spine, the coronal balance, but we don't talk about the axial balance very much. So all of the surrounding structures, say the disc has lost some of its height and really bad facet arthropathy at one level, it's a little bit unusual, because typically that would come along with some level of instability, spondylolisthesis. But restoring the height of the disc closer to a normal level allows those soft tissues to get a little bit closer to their normal length-tension relationship. And that's how they function better. Okay. We know the studies in the cervical spine, if before cervical plates were used readily, that we would use structural autograft, and patients would tend to fall into some kyphosis. That is much larger predictor of adjacent segment disease. So restoring the alignment, not that it won't happen, there's certainly still a risk of that, but from a surgical standpoint, if you're very careful with the alignment of the spine in all planes of movement, you can probably lessen that chance.
So one of the other new technologies that is sort of coming, endoscopic spine procedures. And so one endoscopic procedure that sort of does sort of balance between interventionalists as well as surgeons would be an endoscopic rhizotomy. And so while the data is still coming, those who have been doing these procedures clearly have shown the length of duration being far longer than the traditional needle-approached RFA. So I think that's something that, you know, as a society and as experts in the spine field, we should be looking at going forward. Yeah. You know, there's one last wrinkle to this case, and I should have mentioned it on the MRI. This patient has some multifidi atrophy. So if the patient has multifidi atrophy, and if on physical exam they have positive a positive test for that multifidi atrophy, does motor stimulation play a role? It seems like that's a new thing coming, no?
Yes. So I think, you know, do we really know, does multifidus atrophy mean that a patient will necessarily respond to some of these multifidus stim or restorative type therapies? Yeah. I think I would say no, we don't yet. As sort of a biomarker, the way MODIC is probably a decent biomarker for someone who might respond to the basal vertebral nerve ablation procedure. But I would definitely agree that this is an interesting area. I think we're all a bit, you know, we're all fascinated with the possibility of a restorative therapy as opposed to you know, a palliative or destructive therapy like RF or fusion or anything that's you know, the idea of forcing physical therapy long-term with the multifidi with some of these therapies is definitely appealing. Yeah. And I think it is the patients too. The idea of literally, you know, strengthening up the deep stabilizers as opposed to burning something or putting screws in their spine is appealing. So, you know, there are ongoing studies, and I think I know there are more in the pipeline that we're going to learn more in the coming years about, you know, how well does, you know, motor activation of multifidi, essentially working out the multifidi over, you know, weeks to actually years, depending on the technology that you're using, how well is that going to work for some of these patients? And I think there's still some refinement of selection that we need to understand better from what I've read so far. But very much agree, hot topic, interesting area, and I bet we're going to know a lot more in 3 to 4 years.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree. And kind of as a summary for this case with individuals who have more of a posterior column pathology, new and emerging technology coming, both from an endoscopic approach as well as a restorative approach, despite having great current treatments, right, really is going to be something that we're going to be interested in following, wanting to know, do these patients actually get better over time? And given that our population is continuing to age, facet arthropathy, spondylosis becomes a larger percentage of our clinical day. So this is exciting, and we're going to stay tuned in to see where this comes in a couple of years. The third case for this session is going to involve more of a middle column pathology. This is a patient presenting in their, say, mid-70s, still trying to be very active, but over the last few years has clearly noticed the longer she stands and the further she walks, the more difficult she's having with an axial back pain with some form of radicular complaint. And she sort of presses on the tops of both of her thighs. She says that she feels at times her legs may even become a little jello-y or weak, and that if she doesn't get to a chair, she's very worried that she might fall and lose her balance. On MRI, it's fairly clear that you see at least one level of moderate to severe central spinal canal stenosis. And in this particular scenario, the ligamentum flavum and facet hypertrophy are playing far more of a role than necessarily a broad-based disc protrusion. Again, patient has exhausted the conservative therapies with chiropractic care, home physical therapy, medications. Even sometimes the medications are causing side effects, as many of the gabapentinoids tend to do in our elderly population. They've had even a couple epidurals, so I'm kind of going to turn to Dr. McCormick for some advanced intervention with like a posterior approach distraction device in the inner spinous space versus a minimally invasive percutaneous decompression.
Yeah, so, you know, a patient who it sounds like has classically had low back pain, but it's now evolving into more of a neurogenic claudication picture and, you know, stenosis, as you mentioned. So I guess it would be interesting to know a couple of things I'd want to know from the imaging particularly is, you know, one, FlexX views. So is this patient unstable? That's going to totally change everything. So if they're unstable, you know, I wouldn't be offering any kind of one of these devices where, you know, I'd be referring to one of my colleagues and for surgical solutions to stabilize a segment that may be contributing to the claudication because it's unstable. Second one on the MRI, I think you alluded to, you know, mainly ligament of flavum buckling or, you know, redundancy being contributing to the stenosis. So if we're assuming there's stability there, and there isn't, you know, critical or severe stenosis, theoretically, you know, the percutaneous ligament of flavum decompression could be a solution. The other thing to consider is what are the subarticular zones look like. So the ligament of flavum, if you decompress that, but there's quite a bit of stenosis in the lateral recess or subarticular zone, it may only partially help. So these are situations where as you alluded to, the posterior spacers, the proprietary devices that essentially create distraction and indirect decompression may be more helpful because you theoretically can reduce some amount of not only central canal stenosis or reduce the dynamic stenosis that occurs when someone's in full extension at, you know, not only the central canal, but the subarticular zones and even the neural foramen. So full disclosure, I don't perform either of those procedures myself, but those would be things that one might be thinking about if you know, considering those options as opposed to, you know, a more classic decompression surgically.
Very nice. Dr. Placide, I'll probably throw you the easiest question here in our session today. Direct decompression fixes this problem. So
ideally,
right. So if one of us has performed an epidural injection, patient's gotten some initial good relief, but for just too short a period of time, why not just directly decompress them? Shouldn't we just send everybody to you?
Well, that's a very good question. I would still go through what, the least invasive to the most invasive. So in our practice, somebody may appear to be a really good surgical candidate and may not have tried the therapies. And some of those patients, you send them for therapy, they're too uncomfortable to participate appropriately. So interventional techniques could potentially decrease the pain enough that they could go through a therapy program more appropriately and actually make some benefit.
Okay.
If that's still not the case, then clearly a standard open laminectomy is not a bad procedure.
And if in the scenario that Dr. McCormick presents where the patient does not have any instability, what is the role of fusion, whether that fusion is traditional pedicle screw instrumentation or a posterior device fixation? Where do those sort of play a role when someone doesn't really truly have instability?
Right. So, have to be a little careful with instability. We do flexion extension x-rays. Typically they're standing, so the patients will often guard. You can also do them lying down and look for true. So you compare someone in a supine to standing position, you may get a better sense of instability.
Okay.
But if a patient has somewhat of a spondylitic disc and loss of disc height and it's not moving, there really is not a role for fusion just because you're doing a laminectomy. Now, for some reason, you're doing an extensive laminectomy and you're removing part of the facet joints. We know that taking over 50% of the facet joint will make it unstable. And you mentioned ligamentum flavum, that attaches right to the underside of the facet capsule. So if you're removing that and there's iatrogenic instability from the cert, then you probably should stabilize that as well. Particularly someone that wants to be active and healthy, they're gonna come back if you don't. And the whole idea of the instability and stabilization, you're either going to stabilize it or not. I don't think you decide, maybe I'll just do these facet things because it might become unstable. You're either going to stabilize it or not. So I don't think some of the newer devices take away using pedicle screw instrumentation. They would be used for the same indication.
Gotcha. Right? And so one of the other questions that I think is that we may try to answer going into the future is, how much decompression is enough decompression?
Yeah, so that is a very good question. I don't think there's a good answer to that. There are proponents of indirect decompression, right? Like this interspinous space. There are people that will do, let's say you have an ischemic spondylolisthesis at L5-S1, L5 nerve root compression. There are folks that'll do a standalone ALIF. That's an indirect decompression. The other camp wants to see the nerve root and decompress it. That's a direct decompression. So how much is enough? It would vary from surgeon to surgeon. I would say you should see the nerve root, and you should have an instrument that you can trace out over the in through the neural foramen out past the pars. And if that is clear, then the decompression's done. That's why it's called decompression.
So I think we're going to leave everyone with an unanswered question that kind of plays into two different camps. How much decompression is enough decompression? And if the individual is someone who just needs to regain basic function in and around the home so that they are not just sort of dependent on assistive devices for mobility, or is it a younger patient who's very active? And in that scenario, may need to make sure that there is adequate and complete decompression. Hopefully we've left you with new technologies that are gonna help to evolve our space. Hopefully we've left you with some questions that we hope to answer in a few years. I certainly wanna thank my two expert colleagues, Dr. Placide, as well as Dr. McCormick. Dr. Singh, thank you so much.